session number 10398, rule 3.
This is Pomeroy, rule 3.
After a stint in the Bulacan Provincial Committee, I was sent to the National Party School, and also our comrade Jose Lava attended the party school. It is in this party school that I felt that I gained more knowledge about the Communist Party and how it works. And although now looking back, it seems to me that the Communist Party at that time was still sort of primitive, because we have developed much more after that. Yet I felt that I needed the atmosphere, you know, of working with comrades, living with comrades, and becoming more and more revolutionary in my outlook. After the party school, it was a school only of 3 weeks, you know. After the party school, I was sent back to Manila to become a member of the United Front Department. The head of this department was a lawyer whose name is Vitaliano Manansala. Vitaliano Manansala is a very fiery person, excessive enthusiasm, in fact. I became the editor of the United Front Bulletin. What is fascinating to me now is the way we got our news, you know, because at that time we could not get news from outside. You can get news by listening to the radio shortwave, but that was prohibited by the Japanese. If you are caught listening to shortwave radio, you would be taken to Fort Santiago and executed. But we had a united front with other guerrillas, you know, like the Philippines, the Free Philippines. The Free Philippines has a man who has been listening to shortwave radio. And the only way we could put out the United Front Bulletin is to get this man to give me the news. You know? So I would meet with this man once a week. You know, I gave him a false name and he gave me a false name. I didn't know who he is. He didn't know who I am. But all we do is that we get together on a certain day, we meet at the corner, then we walk around the university premises, which is rather big. And as we walked, he would give me the news he gets from shortwave radio about the war that's going on in Europe, the war in the Pacific. You know? And as we walked, I would memorize what he said. After he has told me the news, he said, "Okay, you recant," and I will say, "You said this and that and this," and she said, "Oh, you forgot to say this." So until I get it, you know, all the news that he's given me, we don't stop and go round and round. And then we decided that if any one of us would be captured by the Japanese, we must not wait longer than 5 minutes at that place where we usually meet. Because if I do not come at the exact time, we must give each other only 5 minutes and then leave, because it's possible one of us has been caught. Because it was a dangerous times. It was very dangerous at that time. So this happened while I was the editor of the United Front Bulletin.
When was this? Can you put a date on it?
Well, I went to the party school in July, so that must be July. It must be August. August to September. But the thing is, I've been doing this every week with this fellow. Later on, I found out after the war that his name is I.P. Solyongko. He's a very famous columnist of the Tribune. The Tribune is one of the major newspapers in the Philippines, and he's witty. He's a very intelligent fellow, alert, very alert. At that time, my name was Rosa, and he called himself Pedro, which means Peter, you know. That's all we knew about each other. But then, I became wanted in Manila. A Japanese captain with two soldiers came to our house and was looking for me. So, on my way home, my sister intercepted me in the streets and said, "Don't come home." And she had already a bag with her, a bag of my clothes. Says, "You've got to go somewhere else, but don't come home, because she will be arrested." So I had to look for contacts from the party. My contact was the librarian of the Communist Party, I mean, librarian of the University of the Philippines, Gabriel Bernardo. He's a communist too, you know.
How do you think the Japanese found out about you?
I don't know. I was not able to, you know, to investigate that part. But how they came to know where I live and what my name is, I don't know. In fact, my comrades in Manila, when they found this out, they helped my family move out of that to another district. They immediately helped my family move to another district. So, because any one of them might be taken in case they cannot find me. So I contacted the librarian of the University of the Philippines, and he endorsed me to a woman in whose house I lived for 2 weeks. This woman is also a very well-known woman. She is the best harpist in the Philippines. Her name is Elsa O'Farrell. And she gave me refuge in her house for 2 weeks. She's a middle class. She belongs to the middle class. It's a beautiful house. And she has a bedroom with a fantastic bed, you know, with a screen up there. And she gave me that room, which is her room, to sleep in. Now, the thing is, after 2 weeks, I was assigned to go to Central Luzon. When I said goodbye to Elsa O'Farrell, she said, "After the war, let us meet each other." Yes. And I told her, "I don't know whether I live to see the end of the war, because I'm doing very dangerous work." "Oh yes, we will live to see the war. You just come to see me, because you know where I live. I do not know where you live. I don't even know who you are. So you should take the initiative of looking for me after the war." Now, I will tell you this briefly, because after the war, when I came back to Manila and was trying to look for Elsa O'Farrell, I was told by Gabriel Bernardo, this man, that she has become insane because he was arrested by the Japanese, because he was also entertaining a man who comes from the guerrilla forces, Yusafe, they call it Yusafe. And it is not me who was the cause of her arrest. It is this man who was coming frequently to her house and asking for money, you know, contributions. And she was struck down. She was taken to Fort Santiago. She was raped. She was tortured. That caused her insanity. And she said, Gabriel Bernardo told me, "Even if you visit Elsa O'Farrell in the hospital, she will not know who you are." See? So what? I was the one who was afraid that I might not live after the war. Oh, sorry. And it is she who became the casualty of the war. Now, I was taken to Central Luzon by a young woman courier. And I was told that I would take the place of the editor of our underground newspaper called Katubusan. Katubusan means redemption. And this man, this young man, who is the editor of Katubusan, will be sent to Manila to take my place as the editor of the United Front Bulletin. Because he is also wanted in the place where he's staying. I'm wanted in Manila, so we will exchange. That I was told to see him before he leaves, so he could brief me on the work of the Katubusan, and I could brief him on the work of the United Front Bulletin. So I was to go to we went on foot, you know, from Manila to the town of San Ildefonso. This is in Bulacan. We took a rig, you know, in the Philippines at the time, you cannot find any means of transportation except the Filipino rig, the rig and the horse, you know.
Rig?
Rig.
R-I-G?
R-I-G. It is a...
like a cart?
Yes, like a cart. But it is for passengers, and the horse is the means of transportation. We can only go as far as San Ildefonso from there. That's Bulacan, you see. I traveled to Nueva Ecija on foot. I think we had to travel for 5 days before I reached San Carlos. San Carlos is a village in Nueva Ecija. I was told that I would meet this fellow whose name is Justado. They call him Dading. Dading is his nickname, but his real name is Justado. Justado happened to be the son of Comrade Mateo Castillo, who is now a very famous man in our history, because he was a peasant leader, a very well-known peasant leader in Central Luzon and in Manila, everywhere else. Justado Castillo was the comrade whose place I would take as editor of the Katubusan. Now, when we arrived in San Carlos, I was placed in the house of a comrade, and I was going to meet him at that house, in fact, around 2 o'clock in the afternoon. But in the morning, this is a very exciting story for me. I don't know how it would appeal to others, but to me, this is a very exciting moment, because when I was taking a bath, because I was going to see this fellow in the afternoon, I heard our comrade, you know, say, I was using the pseudonym or the alias Lydia. My name was Lydia. And this comrade said, Lydia, please finish your bath right away and come down to the front of the house. And the way he spoke is, the tone of his voice made me feel there is some danger of some kind. So I immediately finished my bath and came down. And there, you know, the house of this man is right next to the river, the Agno River. And there is only a footpath between his house and the river. And alongside the river are bamboo groves. I don't know if you're familiar with bamboo groves. If you lived in India, you would have seen bamboo groves. Along the river are about 8 or 10 bamboo groves. And he said to me, there was a ladder resting on the bamboo grove. He said to me, the Japanese are in the next village and they're coming this way. So I'd like you to climb that bamboo grove, because inside the bamboo grove, he said, is a flooring. There is a floor that we've made there, good for 3 people. There are already 2 people in there. Get in there and stay there, because we expect the Japanese to passing through here. So I climbed as fast as I could, you know. And when I got into the middle of the bamboo grove, the 2 men, you know, helped me down. And we can only squat, you know, and sit there, the 3 of us. There was just enough room for 3 people. Then in less than 10 minutes, the Japanese came. And our comrade warned us not to be, you know, not to make the least noise. And when the Japanese came, there were about, my estimation must be 80 or to 100. But there were Filipinos in front of them. This must be the collaborators, you know, who know the village very well and would spot anyone who is not a native of the village. We watched between the bamboo groves. We could see them, you know. And they were very noisy. You could tell they were Japanese. Then all the people in the village were gathered in the chapel, because the Japanese is going to talk with them. And the only people left in the houses were the children. Now, around 12:30, we were already very hungry. And I thought, my God, when will these people finish their business with the Japanese and give us some food? Now, in a few minutes, there is the son of this comrade in whose house I live. He's just about 14 years old. And he said to us, he put, you know, he wrapped rice, boiled rice, in banana leaves. This is a custom in the Philippines of wrapping food in banana leaves and tie them up. And he put them at the end of a long rod. And he said to us, "Catch this. See, I'm going to project this into the bamboo groove and catch it." And so he put it up there, and we caught the rice, you know. And in it, there's a small parcel with salt. And then he says, "There's something more coming." And he went to the house, came back, and there is, he had another parcel with him wrapped in banana leaves. And he asked us to catch it. And it was fish, you know, grilled fish for us. And then I shouted, "What about water? We have to drink." "Okay," he said, "don't worry, I'll give you water." And he put water in a bottle. He tied something at the, you know, the mouth of the bottle. And he also gave it to us, you know. This 14 years, you can see that even children are organized in that village, you know. This is how I saw our party, how our party worked in the past. Because how could you get people to cooperate like this unless they've been organized by our party? People must have been going there, you know, over the years and organizing these people. Why is the cooperation so marvelous, you know? So they went on, and the Japanese left the village about 5 or 6 o'clock. And there we were. We got to know one another, you know, the three of us. Without saying who our names are, each of us gave one another our background, what we did in the past, you know. And we became very good friends. Well, in the evening, we were still there in the inside the bamboo group. But then our host said, "Okay, Lydia, I'll ask you to come out now," because he could not stomach the fact that I'll have to sleep there. It becomes very cold at night, and I'll sleep there with these two men. Although he's not afraid that these two men will do me any harm, just the idea that I'd be crouching there, you know, because Filipinos has this great respect for women, this caring attitude towards women. So he said, "I'm going to take a chance. I'll get you out of there, and if something happens, we'll think of something to protect you." So I came down the ladder. This time, I came the ladder very slowly because I was being pricked by the bamboo. When I went up that ladder, I didn't feel anything. I went up so fast. But this time, coming down, I could feel all the pricks of this bamboo because it has spikes. So I slept in the house of this comrade. And very early in next morning, I was taken to the forest of Cabiao.
What had the Japanese been looking for when they visited the village?
Were looking for guerrillas. And I found out from this comrade when I was about to leave the village that all the bamboo groves along that river are filled with guerrillas like myself. 3 people in each bamboo grove. There must have been about 8 or 10. And they had done this, you know, they had put a flooring inside the bamboo grove for guerrillas. And this is how they protect us, you know. And I was very much impressed by the kind of, you know, work that they do for the party. It's the party people who have been, this is the idea of the party people in that village, you see. After the Japanese had left the village, I stayed in the house of this comrade who was my host. And early the next morning, I was taken to the forest of Cabiao, and I had to ride on a carabao. You have seen a carabao, haven't you?
No. Oh, caribou.
Caribou, you call it, yes.
Like a buffalo.
Yes, yes. Now, what I did not know at that moment was that this comrade, whose place I was going to take, was captured by the Japanese. He was already in San Carlos, the village where I was staying, but he was in another part of the village. And because he was going to Manila, he was all dressed for Manila, you know, looking like a city slicker. And he did not want to dive into the river to get wet. So he just hid among the bushes. And luckily for him, the Japanese came with dogs. And the dogs discovered him among the bushes and ferreted him out. And he was taken by the Japanese to the town of Cabiao. I later found out that he was tortured. His armpits were burned. His private parts were burned before he was executed. I found this out when I was already in the forest of Cabiao, where some comrades were there to meet me. 3 days after this incident in San Carlos, one of our comrades came into the forest and told us about this. So that evening we were all feeling very bad, felt very frustrated about what happened. And then we had a meeting where we paid tribute to him. We had a ceremony of a 5-minute silence, and we pledged that in revenge for what has been done to him, we shall carry on with more vigor and enthusiasm in the fight against the Japanese. And I promised myself that having taken his place, I will try to do a good job in editing Katubusan, because that is the only way I can redeem the torture that was inflicted on him. So this Katubusan was, when I became the editor, the first copies of Katubusan was produced in the forest of Cabiao. Cabiao is a town, you see, but there is this big forest in Cabiao where we use this forest for our, most of our comrades use the forest of Cabiao for our guerrilla forces, you know, as hiding place. But the time came when there was a big storm and we had to evacuate and go to the villages again. We had to move out of the forest of Cabiao. I stayed in another village called Santa Rita. Santa Rita is spelled S-A-N-T-A, capital R-I-T-A. And there, I resumed the publication of Katubusan. Now, at that time, we had so little money, so our finances was very, very poor. So Katubusan only came out as 2 pages, you know, both sides. Later on, during the struggle, because I was editor of Katubusan for 2 years, it became 4 pages. Later on, it became 6 pages. At the end of the war, it became 8 pages while I was the editor. And at first, we were only 3 working in Katubusan. I was the only writer. I did all the writing of the news and the editorial. One is my other companion is a typist. The other one is the mimeographer. We had a mimeograph with us and 1 typewriter. So after I've done the paperwork, 1 comrade will type it, and then the 2 of them will mimeograph the copies. And these copies are distributed all over the provinces where we have strong influence. So this became the newspaper of the Hukbalahap of our guerrilla forces.
Was the Hukbalahap just for communists, or did you have other people in the Hukbalahap?
Oh, other people. Did I tell you that the Hukbalahap was born officially on March 29, 1942? The commander-in-chief was Luis Taruk. I've already told you about Luis Taruk. The vice commander was a man whose name is Alejandrino. What's his first name? I will ask Bill his first name. I forgot now. Casto Alejandrino. And the political commissar was Mateo Castillo, the father of Diosdado Castillo. He's a peasant leader. Luis Taruk is a peasant leader in Central Luzon. Casto Alejandrino was the mayor of a town called Arayat. They are all communists. So the Hook Balab was really led by the communists. But the rank and file are not all communists. In fact, the rank and file are mostly non-communist people who have joined us. But we see to it that the commander of each squadron or of and the political commissar are communists. Now, the vice commander could be someone outside the party. But the great majority, the rank and file of the Hook Balab are not communists, but they have sympathies and respect for the Communist Party.
You mentioned other guerrilla groups who were operating against the Japanese. Can you tell me more about those?
Oh, there are so many. Right now I cannot remember the names of each one, but I would like to tell you about this Yusafe, this one that Bill was talking about. The Yusafe are guerrillas who really are just waiting for General MacArthur to come back to the Philippines. They just stayed in the forest or went to the villages to ask for food, but they did not really conduct any guerrilla activities. They just waited until General MacArthur would come back to the Philippines, and then they would support General MacArthur's military activities. So they were just foraging from the people, but doing nothing.
Were they organized by the American army?
Yes, some American officers who stayed behind, who stayed in the Philippines, organized the Yusafe. And later on, because they terrorized people, they were so arrogant and cocky, many of the people with whom they stayed hated them. They were called Tulisafe. Because Tulisafe came from the word Tulisan. Tulisan means bandit. So it's bandit Yusafe. We also adopted this word Tulisafe because they were very hostile towards us. Towards the end of the war, they killed many of our soldiers. They killed a whole squadron. Well, I'll tell you about this when we get to the end of the war. But they were so hostile against us, we were frightened. We were afraid of them. I mean, those of us who are civilian workers, of course, our military forces are not afraid of them. They're ready to fight.